Hi, this is Katie Day, and welcome to Creating Ripples, the programme that showcases inspirational women across the globe. Sometimes it is the small acts and achievements that can create the biggest ripples. We're here to share some amazing stories. They will make you laugh. Sometimes they may make you cry. They will always inspire you. Today, it is my absolute pleasure to be interviewing Marion Eaton. When newly married, cash-strapped and pregnant, Marion set up her solicitor's practice in a small market town in the 1970s, when women solicitors were very few. Little did she think that 25 years later, through mergers and acquisitions, her firm would become part of one of the largest and most prestigious legal firms in the southeast of England. While still working in the firm, she was able to follow a lifelong interest in natural medicine and celebrated her 47th birthday by qualifying as a professional aromatherapist and Reiki master. For some years, she practiced law and complementary medicine side by side, opening the Professional Centre for Holistic Health in Hastings Old Town in East Sussex in the UK, which provided facilities for some 16 therapists in the late 1990s. Retiring from the legal profession in 2004, Marion continued to practice aromatherapy and Reiki and to teach various workshops until she retired, in inverted commas, to the country in 2008, where she still teaches Reiki and other workshops with a complementary health and metaphysical theme. Now she has discovered another passion for writing. To date, she has self-published 8 books under the name of M.L. Eaton. The first is a fictionalised memoir entitled Soliciting from Home, which I think is one of the best book titles I've ever heard, which she wrote under the pseudonym Melanie Russell. 3, the Mysterious Marsh series, are legal mystery thrillers with a touch of history and a supernatural twist. 3, the Faraway Lands series, are fictionalised memoirs of a childhood spent in exotic locations. And the last, entitled Spinning into Form, is an explanation of subtle energy combined with meditations. She is currently working on a book entitled Sacred Earth, which reflects her 30-year fascination with earth energies and ameliorating the effects of geopathic stress. Goodness gracious me, Marion. I'm feeling hugely inadequate for saying that. What a phenomenal life you've had so far.
I've been very lucky.
Soliciting from home, that's just... Who thought of that? That's just brilliant.
It just had to be somehow.
That is just brilliant. Fantastic. So what motivated you to get into law, first of all? We go back to the beginning.
But at the very beginning, well, I went to an all-girls school.
Uh-huh.
And it was a grammar school in those days.
Oh.
And my brother was 12 years older than me and emigrated to Australia.
Oh,
so
wow.
There were no men around. Living with my mother, father and grandfather. So no young men around, I should say. So I thought, what can I do with my A-level subjects that would possibly bring me closer to a lot of men?
Oh, well, you're a woman after my own heart.
That's how I thought law would be interesting. And since none of the other girls at my school had ever done law or studied at university level, I was the first person from my grammar school to go to study it.
How exciting.
So that was good. And I've discovered that that was really something I was...
Trailblazer.
Good at, yes. And it was good, actually, because, I mean, in those days, back in the late 60s, everything, even from grammar schools, they were thinking of going to either teaching or secretarial.
Yeah.
Or
nursing.
That's it. The three things.
That was the other one. I can remember careers. You know, yeah. These are what you can do before you get married and have children, girls.
Exactly. And then when you get married and have children, it all goes up. So it's a complete waste to be a lawyer. So I went to Bristol University because my father had been there, my brother had been there, my cousins had been there. And I was very lucky. I think there were 100 places that year and only 10 went to women. So
goodness,
I was one
gracious.
Of 10.
Wow.
And when I left, I wasn't sure if I wanted to actually practice law. And my brother had just been divorced and his wife had disappeared, so he asked me to go and help him look after his children, which I did, but he was a veterinarian.
Okay.
And so I also had to be his veterinary nurse, and so I had a great time. I learned all about
grief.
And he just set up a practice, and it was such fun. It really made me understand what you could do if you had your own business.
Okay.
But of course, I couldn't then do it. So I had to find, in those days, it was articles of clerkship. Now they call it a training contract for solicitors. And I should say solicitors are the lower branch of the profession, similar to attorneys in America.
Oh, really? Okay.
And barristers
are
senior. There's
a real hierarchy.
Oh, yes, very much so. The general public can actually instruct a solicitor, but they can't instruct a barrister direct.
Ah.
Might be coming in any minute now, but for
interesting
ever.
So they're instructed by the solicitor?
By the solicitor,
on behalf,
yes,
of the solicitor's clients?
That's right.
Okay. Didn't know that.
And just out of a funny little thing, I don't know if you've noticed, but on the back of barristers' gowns, they have their wigs and their gowns, there's a pocket on one side.
Oh,
I
haven't.
A big thing like this. And on the other side, there is a long strap. The solicitor would be sitting behind the barrister in court. And if he wanted to attract his attention, he would just pull on this strap.
would he put a note in the pocket?
He could put a note in the pocket, or that was for cash, because barristers never took money. So you had to pay him, so you couldn't pay him face to face. He had to receive his fee in his pocket. So just out of interest.
Love it.
The intriguing little bits about the law. But anyway, I then went and became... it was very difficult to find articles as a woman because, again, as we were saying, they were just worried that you'd go off and get married and leave, have children.
Mm-hmm.
So eventually my uncle by marriage, offered me some articles, an article clerkship. So I was there for 2 years and then took my finals, and then I got married and went to Australia.
Oh my gosh, you missed that one, that bit out of the bio.
I was only over there for a year.
Oh, okay.
But I did work on Circular Quay in Sydney, which was lovely, in the AMP building, and I really love Sydney. Then we came back to England with my Australian husband, and I worked in Rye, just locally, for a while, as an assistant solicitor, and... Then it started, my book, Soliciting from Home, sort of comes from then, because I became pregnant and we'd had lots of work done in the house and there was hardly any money anywhere. So I went to the bank manager and I asked him for a loan. And he asked what I did. And I said, I'm a solicitor. Oh, we need those in Lid. We need one of those in Lid. I can send all these people to you. So I said, yes, but I'm having a baby. I want to be a stay-at-home mum. I don't want to have to go to work anymore. But before I knew it, he'd actually sent people round knocking on my door to make wills.
Well, thank goodness for that bank manager, I say.
Absolutely. So I had so much support from him.
That's brilliant. And
so it was very funny in the first few days, first few months before I had the baby, because... The dog used to bark at anybody who came. I had this funny old manual typewriter and I had to type everything. It was one my brother had left when he'd gone back to Australia. It's very, very small. And so I was typing away on that. And of course with wills, I don't know if you know this, but with wills you can't make a mistake in the will because it has to run in a certain fashion. If you make a mistake, you have to go back and start retyping it.
But you couldn't use Tippex then?
No, you could not use Tippex because it would all show an alteration in the will. So you had
the pressure.
And I was not trained as a typist, so it was
goodness.
Not only that, but they were double sheets of paper because you couldn't have anything attached to a will in case it fell off and then people thought there might have been a codicil or something.
Okay.
So you had to use one piece of paper that was doubled over. And of course, when you put it into the typewriter, it usually came through all right. But if you made a mistake on the last page, you had to start from the very beginning again.
God.
So let's say my typing skills became rather slow but quite precise.
Yeah, absolutely. Did you specialise in a particular area of law?
At that time it was mostly wills because it was just easy, but one-off things to do. And I met some very, very interesting people. But then gradually, anything else that was a problem used to end up at my door. So I had all sorts of interesting things. Which was why I had to write a book about it, because it was just so many different characters and so many intriguing problems. One person came along to me and said, I'm sure there are Pakistanis in my loft. What? I'm sure. I said...
You should have me take a coffee at that point.
She said, and what's more... One of them has died up there. And I'm going, oh, I think, saying to myself, I think she might be slightly bonkers. I kept my cool and I said, well, I'll come around and inspect the property. And it was quite true. And I got there was this dreadful smell up in her bedroom. And you could see this mark on the roof, which I thought was just damp.
Okay.
Anyway, I said to her, well, I'll ring the police and see if they'll come along and have a look at it. You know, they ought to. They weren't really very interested at the time. But eventually, some years later, we did discover that it had indeed been the case that people had brought in. In those days, it was Pakistanis who were the illegal immigrants, and they were being brought into the shore, shipped to Lid, where we were. I was in
really?
Practice, and they had been hidden in various
really?
Places.
Really? So she...
She was absolutely right.
Oh,
and
my
she
gosh.
Said, of course, one of the things she said to me was, I was a matron in Changi during the war, and she said, and I know the smell of death when I smell it. So, of course, I would think she's completely bonkers, but she obviously wasn't.
Oh, my goodness.
But it's one of the stories in my book because there's rather more to it than that.
Absolutely. It wasn't blood dripping from the ceiling.
No, it wasn't blood, though.
Okay.
No.
Amazing. I bet you really got to see every side of human nature, didn't you, doing that job?
Yes, most. I did steer away from crime. I didn't like crime very much. And so we had a murder. And everybody was saying, oh, you're going to be acting for the murder, in the murder. And I said, no, I don't think so. So I didn't actually act in that one. I kept away from those things. But it's amazing how many little problems come to solicitors.
Really?
And things like accident claims.
Right.
Somebody used to come and ask me to interpret things like insurance documents.
Right.
I could check those for them. There's the usual conveyancing, which is always divorce. Neighbourhood disputes, any dispute, come to that. Debt collections, wills, probate.
Fascinating.
Absolutely fascinating, yes.
Wow.
So it's much wider than you think.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Much more interesting.
Yeah, because now if you go into a solicitor's or a legal practice, you tend to have attorneys stroke solicitors dealing with a particular area of the law, don't you? Whereas you are kind of like a generalist. You just kind of took anything that came your way.
Yes, and it was much more fun.
A lot more fun. A lot more fun.
Towards the end, I did have to specialise because we merged into a bigger firm and it was much more, organised, really. And so you had to choose a branch that you could work in. And I ended up doing lots of wills again.
Okay.
Partly because I wanted to go part-time, but partly because I wasn't frightened of discussing death.
Yeah, it's a tricky subject, isn't it? And particularly in the UK, I think we're really rubbish at talking about death.
We are, absolutely. Yeah. It's ridiculous.
We've got no idea how to handle it at all.
And men in particular don't really like to even think about it. They don't even say when you die. They say, if something happens, you know it's going to happen. You know something is going to happen. At some stage, it's going to happen to you.
It's the only guarantee the second you're born, isn't it, that you're going to die?
Absolutely.
Everything else is an uncertain, but that's an absolute guarantee. It's really interesting that we are almost illiterate when it comes to talking about death. We're paralysed. We just don't know how to handle it at all.
No, and it's very sad, really.
It is.
My father, because he was a Victorian, he was in the Victorian years, a lot of people used to lost people, and also he went through two world wars, so he was used to death being around him and being bereaved, and he always said that people needed to talk about it.
Mm.
So I always remember when I had my first baby at home by mistake.
Baby by mistake, I hope it's by mistake. Had you figured out how you got pregnant?
I got pregnant. But I was expecting to go to... I was expecting to go to hospital, but she was born very suddenly at home.
Gosh.
Literally in about 20 minutes.
Oh, my Lord.
And I hadn't managed to put the kettle on and comb my hair and take my husband a cup of tea or all the things he was supposed to do. And so when the midwife came around the following morning to show me how to breastfeed, I was desperately trying to learn, and my father said to her, are you married? And she said, no, I'm a widow. And he said, oh, when did your husband die? And she said, oh, about 10 years ago. What did he die of? And so they were having this amazing conversation about everything. She just told him everything about the way her husband had died. And she said afterwards, you know, nobody ever asked me. They don't want to know.
They don't want to listen. It's shocking, actually. It's such an important conversation. There's an amazing chain of cafes called death cafes. Have you heard of those?
No, I haven't, actually.
Where people who have been bereaved can go along and just talk about in a group and to celebrate the life of the person that they've lost. And they're called death cafes. I think it's a brilliant idea.
It's so important. Yes, yeah. Perhaps you ought to start some.
Maybe we should.
Okay. I'm not sure about the death cafe. Perhaps you ought
to. No, I think I'd rather have a different title, but I think the concept.
The idea
is
it's been extremely good, and I think you need to be open about death. But I think it does sound a bit as though you're
death
going
cafe
to be.
Death cafe does sound something from Hell's Angels or something.
Look in the coffee
over the top of the door as you go in. Anyway, moving on. So, how did you go from working from home to being merged and acquisitioned?
Well, it did take place over quite a lot, long time. So I, it's difficult to describe the complete way of doing it. Basically, I started off on Romney Marsh in Lydd, and then I opened an office in Hastings. And worked in the old town for about 15 years. And then all sorts of things happened at one stage in my life. My parents used to live with us, and they both died within 6 months, and my husband's mother died. So suddenly there was, it was very difficult. There was just me, my husband, and we had two assistant solicitors, and somehow everything just went pear-shaped at that time. Very difficult. So I looked around for someone to merge
with.
Right. And we merged the firm with another firm, smaller firm. And then I continued to work in that. And it was around about the 1980s, 88, 89, quite a difficult time. And then from there, that firm then merged with that larger firm.
Okay.
And they were actually gobbling up all sorts of little firms. Right. So, but now it's one of the biggest ones.
Is it really? Which one was that?
Gaby Hardwick.
Oh my gosh, really? Wow. They have a real strong presence down
there.
They do,
absolutely.
How fascinating.
So it's because we were Eaton & Co. and then we became Eaton Sagar.
Yeah.
And then
I remember Eaton Sagar.
You do remember Eaton
Sagar? Yes,
Sagar.
I do.
Well, I was Eaton bit of the Eaton Sagar.
Wow, who knew? So what really fascinates me when I was reading through your bio is that rarely do I meet people who are equally balanced in left and right brain. So, you know, the left brain went into the law,
that's
and
right.
The right brain's gone into the Reiki
that's right.
And all the rest of it. Was that interest always there? Was it lying dormant, waiting for the right time? Or did something happen that sparked an interest in that side of who you are? How did that all happen?
I think I'd always been interested, and particularly working with my brother as a veterinary assistant, I'd seen how animals heal. They heal so easily.
Interesting.
And then when my children were very small, one of my daughters had a real problem with her chest, and she was constantly ill. She was on a 3-week cycle of antibiotics.
Oh my gosh.
Being better, coughing and spluttering, and being on antibiotics again. And she looked dreadful. She was only about 3 or 4.
Mm.
And my mother-in-law said, "Why don't you try homeopathy?"
Uh-huh.
And so I went to a homeopath and one remedy, and she was absolutely fine.
Wow.
I've never used, well, no, she has had antibiotics since, but not very often, because mostly we use homeopathy. And the same with my elder daughter. She found the remedy that was exactly right for her. So I was thinking of doing that, actually. But again, it's sitting across a desk, and you're talking to someone.
Yeah.
And I really felt that I wanted to get my hands on somebody. I wanted a contact. So when my daughter was, she was at school, and she's in her final year, and she wanted to be a physiotherapist, and then she was going to have a gap year in Australia. So I found a place for her to go and learn aromatherapy, because I thought that'd be great. She could take that as a nice little package, and when she went to Australia, she could practice and come back, and if she was going to do physiotherapy, it's all there. But unfortunately, her school started keeping her there on Saturdays because she was in certain sports teams.
Right.
So I rang up to cancel and found myself saying, "But I'd love to do it."
So you heard those words coming out of your mouth before you could stop them.
Absolutely, absolutely. So that's what happened. So I went along and loved it. And it was just so different, because as soon as you touch somebody in that professional calm way with compassion, it opens a different aspect of them to you and you to them. And so it's very much a two-way process, and it's just lovely. So I'm very good at giving people good advice across the table, but I think I'm even better at just communicating through touch.
Yeah.
Which is why also Reiki's like that as well. I still think that Reiki, although you can do it off the body and it works, and distantly it works, there's something about that touch that makes a little difference.
I was going to ask you that, because I've had Reiki a few times, but it's never been with touch.
Oh, hasn't it?
No, it's always kind of been, you know, the energy coming from Reiki Master's hands, and I kind of feel heat and they feel heat, but I've never actually had it where I've been touched. I didn't realise that those two went together.
Oh, how interesting. Yeah. Because, yes, that's the way I was taught, and that's the way I understand. Primarily, it's about very gentle touch, as if you were cradling a baby bird. You just use your gentle hands.
Mm.
And in that way, it's just, it releases a lot of tension instantly, because as babies, we need touch. You know, we don't thrive if they're not touched.
Absolutely. Touch is, I was having this conversation with somebody at the weekend who does a similar thing with touch, different to you. And we were talking about how crucial it is for the emotional stability and well-being of human beings. And absolutely, it's so, touch is so underrated, isn't it?
It is.
Because we're not allowed to touch children in schools now, which is ridiculous. And what kind of future generation are we creating?
Exactly. That's really sad. To my mind, that's one of the saddest things. Yeah. Because children run to you for protection.
I know.
And it's just
awful.
You just feel you should be able to give it.
It's awful.
I know when we went, many years ago, we took my children to Greece. And as we got off the little boat onto this little tiny island, there were lots of lovely Greek people waiting for us. And they said, never worry about your children. They will be absolutely safe here. And you're just ruffling the girl's hair with this, as she said that. And they were just going, oh, so nice. And I always felt that that was lovely. They're very much more tactile than we are.
Well, Southern Europeans tend to be, don't they? You know, you go to Greece, Italy, Spain.
That's right.
They're far more tactile with children, and it's a very different attitude.
And in Africa too. Yeah. There's African friends, and they, you know, always have.
Yeah, okay.
They've had to be very careful in England to sort of rein it in
a bit.
One of my friends says, "Oh, you are African."
What part of Africa?
I've actually went to Sierra Leone when I was
did you?
When I was young. I was about 8.
Gosh.
I remember it well.
Gosh. How long were you there?
Not very long, only a summer holiday.
Okay.
Because my father was a civil engineer, so he was always doing a project and then coming home.
Right.
But that particular one, I remember very well because I was a bit older. And because it's a short time, nothing had a chance to really merge into anything else, if you know what I mean. It's like a snapshot.
And a snapshot, yeah.
And the feelings and the smells and the emotions and everything.
Incredibly powerful, those memories, aren't they?
They are. And writing about them has been really good because it's made me remember what I remembered, because you forget how much you really have somewhere deep in your subconscious on all sorts of levels. Smells will often bring it out. You know, aromatherapists always say that.
Well, I mean, smells are incredibly emotive, aren't they? And they can take you back to a snapshot of your past in a nanosecond.
Absolutely.
Yeah, they're incredibly powerful. We underestimate the senses, I think.
We do, particularly ones, smell. Particularly smell, yes, and taste sometimes.
And tastes, yes, absolutely.
I mean, they are connected very much.
They are connected, yeah.
But the sense of smell is connected directly into your reptilian brain at the back of your head, and so it takes you straight there. It's automatic. Whereas other things like sight tends to get mediated through the brain, and they turn the images upside down, do all sorts of things, don't they?
Yeah.
It's a slower process, but the sense of smell goes straight into the limbic brain. Yes,
fascinating. Gosh, so how did you balance both of those parts of you, but both very, very different parts of you? And did you tell each part, the people that you came into contact with, what you did on the other side?
Yes, usually. Because what I came to discover was that with law, it can be very healing, actually, because you're working with people who are nearly always in some form of difficulty, sometimes really emotional and upset, and in very difficult situations, and you are trying to find a way through for them and advise them of the best path they can take through that. And if you do your job properly, And with compassion, and you understand where the other person's coming from, then you can actually heal a lot of situations that you might not.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of that.
Think.
Of course.
So divorce is an obvious one.
Yeah.
If you can actually, there's a certain point in divorce proceedings where if you can just reach an agreement before it gets beyond that point, then it makes life so much easier for everybody. And it's just knowing that bit. So I did actually take a course in, I didn't, in my bio, but in mediation as well, and I found that was really useful,
really
not
important.
In family mediation, but in general mediation. And often people only want an apology, but they get so stuck in this adversarial system of ours, you know, they can't move. And anyone coming to a solicitor, if they're coming to make a will, they're probably thinking of death. If they're coming for probate, someone has died. If they're coming for an enduring power of attorney, they've got someone with dementia. If they're coming for conveyancing their moving house, which is always very emotive. I've mentioned divorce. So generally, if you an accident claim, they've got all sorts of problems and illnesses and everything. So really, there is a lot there that you can do in terms of mediating it and healing it. So in a way, the healing wasn't so big a progression as it might.
I can see that now.
So yes, I did tell people, and I had some great fun because there are all sorts of interesting times when people I knew, either from my profession, my legal professional life, came to see me for some aromatherapy. And we used to have lots of giggles about that because, you know, they were used to seeing me in my suit and suddenly there I was washing oil all over them. And then there were other people who were my legal or aromatherapy clients or something who came to see me in my legal capacity. And there were some who I just met in through the firm. And they'd say something like, oh, I've got sort of bad knee. And I'd sort of say, would you mind if I put my hand on your knee? And they were also surprised that they found it very helpful. So it was so quite often I would get clients from my racial practice, from my legal practice.
Brilliant, I love it.
I'm sure it's probably outside the terms of my practicing certificate, but since I don't need one now, it doesn't matter.
Who the hell cares? So how did you go to be running the Professional Centre for Holistic Health? How did that happen?
Well, when we merged the two, the firm, into we moved into Wellington Square, and so that left me with my premises in the High Street.
Right.
And to begin with, the lovely lady called Jane Metcalf, who started the Hastings Cancer Help Centre, which you've probably never heard of.
No, I haven't.
Because it was back in the early 90s. And unfortunately, there was such a hoo-ha later about the Bristol Cancer Help Centre that it had a knock-on effect and we ended up having to close. But she did a fantastic job of raising the awareness of cancer sufferers to the help complementary medicine generally can give and spirituality can give. And she really opened my eyes a lot to that side of things. And although I'd already done my... That was the beginning of it all, really. And she, at the end of the first year, we had had such a marvellous number of people through giving advice and suggesting things and so on, that she did an amazing celebration for the first anniversary. And one of the people she invited down was Caroline Mice.
Oh, wow.
And she came down to Hastings.
Really?
And she was just amazing and blew me away. And, of course, I was also... all these other therapies were around. We did all sorts of fairs and things, and I just loved the whole feeling.
She's an amazing woman.
Caroline Mice.
I've seen her speak.
Oh, you have, yes.
She's a really sparky lady.
Absolutely.
Wowza.
I'm still a great fan of hers. I've got all her books, and I'm on...
She sees straight through you.
Oh, she does. She absolutely goes.
Didn't take any prisoners, that one. But, yeah, amazing woman. Gosh, how incredible.
And so she...
came down here.
Yes, and she, there were a whole lot of other people too that she invited down. And I can't remember them all because I remember Caroline as being the one that... Caroline being the one that really resonated with me. So from then on I thought... And that's another reason why I went into doing the complementary medicine.
Ah. So how did you get all the people?
Well, really, once you... Well, she started therapists. There. When she gave up, we had a nutritionist who wanted to come in and run a nutrition shop.
Right.
Which he did, and then that was subsequently sold to somebody else. But that was in the front part of our premises.
I remember. I visited.
Remember that, yes.
Yeah. I can remember walking through and then up the stairs.
That's right,
yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so we had quite a few rooms there, and we just advertised to begin with.
Right.
I have mine. no one was going to touch my room. But we graduated, and then of course by word of mouth you found people who wanted to come. And we had several people who came for a little while and then went away. But at the end we had a core of about 16 really good therapists.
Incredible.
And it was just lovely.
So what happened?
Basically, the disability...
Oh my gosh.
In the, as you know, the old town premises don't really lend themselves.
Not even remotely, and they're all listed, so you can't touch them. So there's nothing you can do to put in lifts and ramps.
No, exactly. So, and we also, being lawyers, we also knew that there were lots of openings for claims against us if we didn't do those things. You know, somebody fell over, even if they said they were okay coming down the steps.
Yeah.
And everywhere you went in that building, there were steps.
Yeah.
So it was very sad. But also, I was getting towards my 60th birthday, and so I thought, well, it's probably a good time to just not do quite so much physical stuff.
Fair enough.
So I didn't want it for me. And very luckily, another one opened at Wellington Square.
It did.
Which was wonderful. And so I went and worked there for a little
while. Oh, did you? Ah, so you worked at the Wellington Centre. Yes. Okay.
My main problem there was, again, there were a lot of stairs.
Yes, so how did they get around there? Because there's no lift there either.
Well, it was rather different sort of stairs, and I don't think they...
Okay.
And they also did have a ground floor room that you didn't have to go upstairs to. They had to get upstairs. It worked for them.
Okay.
But I think also that we probably had had enough. It was quite difficult. It's quite like herding cats, trying to get a number of complementary therapists to agree on things.
I can imagine. Yes, you'd need all your mediation skills to come into the fore. Yes.
So, yes, but we were very lucky that we had a successor.
Yeah.
It was so beautiful.
Yeah, but I liked your centre in the old town.
It's very cozy.
It had more soul than the Wellington.
Yes, the Wellington Centre is beautiful, but there was something special about the old town building. There always has been. When we had our solicitors firm there, people used to come in and say, this place has got good vibes.
It has. Mm. And for people in America listening, if they want to find out about Hastings Old Town, they just need to watch Foyle's War.
Absolutely.
And then you will see where Marion had her holistic centre. Because that's where it is.
Just down the steps from
where? Just down the steps from Foyle's house. Yes. That's great. So then you went into writing. Again, was that something that was a dormant desire?
I'd always wanted to write. But it was very funny because having done my legal training, you learn something called legalese, which is I'm laughing, but it's very stilted language. You have to be absolutely clear. Sometimes you don't put any punctuation in things like wills.
Oh, please. Sometimes you never put any punctuation in anything legal. I'm reading
What? That's right. Because it could change the whole purpose of it, the whole meaning of it. So you're not allowed to put punctuation in some things, not all of them.
Okay.
And it's changing now because it's becoming better English.
It's idiot-proof, isn't it, really, for the layman to understand?
Absolutely.
Otherwise, we don't know what we're signing if we don't understand it.
That's why you need a lawyer to explain it to you.
Okay. And you'd never be an answer to that one.
Anyway, yes, so I really wanted to write, and the reason I wanted to write, particularly at that stage, was for my daughters, because they've grown up with the internet, and it's changed the practice of law considerably, and I had this funny story about my first practice and setting up the practice that I really wanted them to know about. So I started writing, and it was awful because it was just so stiff and, it's terrible. I looked at it and thought, oh, this isn't a will. This isn't a legal agreement. This isn't an opinion on something. And I think I went back to it about several times before it was right. And even then, it still needs a few tweaks. And every now and again, I have a look at it and tweak a bit more, which is a nice thing about self-publishing. But the funny thing was that as I was writing, soliciting from home, I'm wondering if I ought to do soliciting from the square or soliciting from the high street. Yeah. Possible. But I was recording things that had actually happened, and a lot of them were quite a lot of ghostly sort of experiences. And supernatural things happening. And I thought, this isn't really what I need to put in a memoir about the law, but it would make a really good story if I can tie some of these things in with some of the legends
So on.
So that in that moment, Hazel Dawkins was born, and her husband, Bruce, and they started a practice, funnily enough, on the marsh, and it went from there.
So is she a solicitor or private investigator?
She's a solicitor.
She's a solicitor.
And some of the stories overlap slightly with the ones in Soliciting from Home, but they were different. They're not the same.
Sure.
But it's because they really happened, it was easier to write about what you know.
Yeah, yeah, of course, it's always easy to write about what you know, isn't it?
And so I've brought in some history and brought in some mystery. And
so that's a Mysterious Marsh series?
Yes.
Interesting. Touch of history. I love the supernatural twist. Wow.
Well, I'll tell you one little story that was quite interesting that's in there. The fact that what made me think about it was not my story, actually. It belonged to a friend of mine, and again, it was a friend of his, who owned one of the houses on the high street in Lydd. And he was a neurologist, and so he had all these different clocks everywhere around. But he was fascinated because at the back of his garden, very narrow garden, there was a rockery. And he didn't know quite what this rockery had underneath it. Well, to cut a very long story short, he found it was a well.
Oh!
But his wife was not at all happy about him doing all this, so he waited till she was out, and then he went down the well. Before he did, he just went indoors, you know, checked the time to make sure she wouldn't be home for a while, went down the well. Suddenly, he heard his wife calling, so he came up from the well, and she said, "Where on earth have you been? I've been here calling you for ages." And he said, "Well, it can't be very, it's only 3:15, looking at his watch." And she said, "No, it isn't, it's 6:00. And he was going, he said, "I must have been down there nearly 3 hours." And she said, they just laughed about it. But when he went indoors, every single one of the clocks had stopped 3:15.
Really?
So that was an interesting story. So I thought,
oh my gosh! See, I can feel a television series coming on.
Would be fun, wouldn't it?
It would be fun. It'd be fantastic. To combine those two.
Yeah, yes, it is. It is fun.
Yeah.
And in fact, a couple of people have said to me it would make a very good television series.
It would make a brilliant television series.
That one's mostly about Romney Marsh and Lydd, the town Lydd. But not quite Lydd, it's changed around a bit, but it was based on that. The next one's in Rye, which has got lots of history as well.
It has lots of history, and Hastings Old Town's got loads of history.
Well,
there is. Around Halloween.
Yes, yeah, yes.
Around Hastings Old Town.
And I'm working towards Hastings. The latest one has been about a Roman altar that's actually in the church at Stone in Oxney. Mm. And that sort of made me think about writing a story. So we have an earthquake and a Roman soldier and the Temple of Mithras and all sorts of exciting things.
Oh, did you know you had this amazing imagination? Well, it's not 100% imagination, isn't it? It's taking stuff that's happened and just expanding it.
Some of it. Yeah. Of course, yes, a lot of it is not necessarily imagination, but I think a lot of people who write history, I mean, I didn't write historical novels, I write a bit of a romp, really. And there's no real sex,
Is there not? Oh, Marion.
No,
rock and roll.
Well, I did try a couple of times, but my beta readers, my sister-in-law and my husband said, "No, cut that bit out. Page 33 is not allowed." So I've gone back to, and there is violence, but it's not sort of, there's only just the odd gunshot and things. It's quite nice.
Have you ever thought of getting a publisher?
I have thought about it, but I actually like the freedom of being self-published.
Do you?
Because you keep your rights.
You do keep your rights, it's true.
And you also, if you go through Amazon or something, you actually get 70% of your royalties instead of a much less amount. Right. And also, you can write what you want. You haven't got to jazz it up or change it or anything.
It's true. It's very true.
So if you're vaguely happy with it, I mean, you're never completely satisfied with what you've written. No. You always feel you could tweak it.
Yeah.
But if you feel that it's more or less okay, or the best that you can do at that time, it's just nice to feel that you've got the ability to change if you want to, or if you like to keep it that way. I mean, I write cross genres, you can gather.
Yeah.
So all those things are not really, they're not saleable in the same way. You only get the blockbusters in the cross genre.
Right, right.
And I should just write plain thrillers or plain mysteries or plain romance or plain ghost stories, and I just mix the three.
So how do you market and promote your books?
Mostly through Amazon, but I've got a Facebook page.
Okay.
I don't do very much in the way of social media because it's very time consuming and it gets a bit banal, I think, sometimes. So I do a few book signings, and there's something called one or two programs that I advertise my book in, and I also have some reviews. I try and get quite a few reviews and get onto blogs and things, and so I've got quite a few nice reviews that way.
Fantastic.
Which makes a difference. So once you get a certain number of reviews on Amazon, you tend to get more sales.
Yeah. It's interesting, that self-published publisher thing, isn't it? Because there's obviously benefits to both. And what's fantastic now is that we do actually have the choice, whereas before
it's brilliant.
We didn't have the choice. It wasn't picked up by a publisher.
Exactly. And I really think anyone who wants to do something, you can just go for it. You can just do exactly what you want to do, and if people like it, great. But I don't really write. I do write for my readers, of course, and I do like people to like my books, of course. But I write because I just need to write, and I'm really enjoying writing, and I just love it.
It's brilliant.
And one or two of them, the memoirs have got quite deep messages as well. Most of them have a certain message. If you look for it, you'll find something a bit deeper than just a story.
How fascinating. You should start a writer's circle or something down here.
I do belong to I belong to some reading circles, and there are some writing circles, but I'm actually fighting clear a little bit of writing circles because think you tend to get a lot of rules thrown around. About how many adjectives you should use and how many adverbs and whether you should use verbs. I am on one or two websites that you write, writers' websites, which actually have been great fun because then you get writers. It's like a writing circle, but you do meet up sometimes, but generally speaking, you don't meet them. And so you don't have to try and be nice all the time. You do, obviously you try and give a nice review, but you can actually be quite honest. And often in a writer's circle, it's much more difficult to be brutally honest to people about
and it's
their
the
writing.
Rules, actually. I'm not very good with rules. And I know if when I read my book back, I know that if I'd gone to a formal writer's circle, they would have completely trashed it because it doesn't meet any of the rules at all.
Exactly. Good.
But the people who have read it, and particularly the people who know me, have come back to me and said I was giggling as I was reading this because it was like being in the room with you speaking.
Yes.
And I said, well, that's how I wrote it. I didn't write it as a book, if that makes sense. No, I wrote it as though I was in a room full of women and I was just chatting to them.
Yes.
Whereas, of course, that doesn't follow any of the rules.
No,
it doesn't.
No rules, but you see, it's so lovely to me.
Kind of be slammed, really. So I absolutely get. Actually, if you're passionate about writing, just write.
Just write, yes. I really enjoy it. And my brother's just written a book. He's 80 and he's terminally ill.
Oh my lord!
But as a vet, he wanted to pass on some of his old-fashioned knowledge, not a bit practical knowledge. He's in Australia, and when he was really ill last Christmas, I gathered all his notes together and I wrote it. And I'm just interested because it's in his voice. It's like he's chatting away to his clients.
Yeah.
And I had to stop myself from trying to make it too bullet pointy. So there are some bullet points because you do need some certain things. But it's called Do I Call the Vet? And What to Do in the Meantime? Right. And it's really a first aid guide plus a bit of idea about nutrition and things that can keep pets healthy.
How wonderful.
And it's just lovely because he sits there and he says, well, you can wrap up this person's, this dog's, dog's wound and just leave it there for a week. He said, and then you take it off, he said, boy, does it smell. And you think, yes. But he said, but you'll find it's all healed underneath. So it's very interesting.
And how wonderful that all that knowledge isn't going to be lost.
Absolutely.
That he's leaving a bit of him behind.
And it's what you've done with your book, you see?
It's what we all do,
yes,
isn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah, anything that becomes a tangible, that comes out of our head and becomes a tangible form, or even this interview. Because, when the interview's finished, the link to it is permanent. So it's about creating our ripples, isn't it? And leaving a bit of ourselves and seeing where they go and what happens with it.
It's a wonderful thought.
It's lovely. I love 30-year fascination with earth energies and ameliorating the effects of geopathic stress. And I'm amazed I actually managed to say that without stopping all the words. What does that mean?
Do you know anything about geopathic stress, or would you like me to explain a bit?
Very little. So
it's really to do with the
not
fact
really,
that where we live and where we walk. We are creatures of the earth, and the earth's energy has an effect on us.
Is this kind of ley line things? No.
It includes ley lines, but it's not just ley lines. Okay. So it includes the whole of nature. But beneath as you say, there are ley lines. Mm-hmm. There's a mixture of what ley lines actually mean. Some people think they're just straight lines in the landscape, which is what Alfred Watkins discovered them, and they are. But they're more or less old track lines, but old tracks, and they've got markers and things. But there are also energy lines that run through the earth. They're not usually straight. They often go in a general direction, but they will...
So when you say energy lines, what do you mean by that? Energy of what?
It's part of the... if you think of ourselves as being electromagnetic beings,
right.
We're okay with that. Yeah. We have electromagnetic resonating now. The Earth is the same. So the Earth is similar to us. It has the same sort of acupressure, acupuncture points and meridians.
Okay. Okay.
If you look at it like that, perhaps that's the easiest way of saying it.
Right.
So we're talking, the energy lines of the earth are like the meridians in the body, but they're not just the meridians in the body, that's the ones that the Chinese mapped.
Yeah.
But then the Ayurvedic system is different. You have the five long energy lines, and then you've got the umbilical line. So as we have different energy systems within our body, bearing in mind that each cell has got a little energy system of its own, and there are, I don't know how many trillion cells within our body, the Earth is similar, so it has an incredible amount of energy. And there are points, that, as we know, and we talk about Stonehenge, but down here in Hastings, if you go and stand on the East Hill or in the Ladies' Chamber and just feel, you can get this immense... It's hard to explain unless you've actually felt it, but it's just energy. I think that's all you can say it is. The problem is if that energy is the sort that is helpful for humans, then we are well when we're sitting in it. But if it, for any reason you're on a place where energy lines cross, or indeed there's various grids around the earth that might cross, then often that is a place where your energy is just drained away.
Goodness.
Because a lot of the grids in particular act as energy sewers for our emotional stuff. So if we're depressed and emotional, it's got to go somewhere. Mm-hmm. It doesn't just all go out into the atmosphere, and it does actually sort of drain away into the Earth's energy grids. And as I say, if they cross, then it becomes a very difficult place for people to be, because they're being fed that negative energy all the time.
How would you know if you're in that place?
Well, quite often you just feel drained.
Okay.
Mostly what it does is to drain your energy. It doesn't actually make you ill. But one of the people who was interested in the energy grids was some Hartmann brothers in Germany. I think it was in the 1930s. And they were interested in cancer patients. And they found that when they discovered this grid through dowsing, that most of their patients were lying on where two negative energy lines crossed.
Goodness.
And sleeping over that.
Wow.
And so then they were just drained of energy.
Good Lord.
So it's really important to be aware. But it's not just that, it's also the whole of the place that you live. You have to consider nature and the other different realms of nature that lie within that. So we've tended to put ourselves in boxes and think of ourselves as being able to do everything with our mind. But our bodies are different. They haven't really caught up with that. And our emotions and are the same.
Fascinating.
So
fascinating.
Really, it's a question that if you are sleeping, or and often people lie above a place where their armchair is, so their bed's above the armchair, so they're in the same energy all the time, because it's coming up from the earth, radiating out from the air. And sometimes it feels comfortable to be in that because you're used to it. It's familiar.
It's the norm, isn't it?
Yes.
It's
so you go normal. Home and you go, oh, I feel tired, and you sit down in that place. And you feel it drain from you quite often. And you think, oh, that's great. I've got rid of all that excess stuff. But maybe you're just sitting in the wrong place and it's not actually doing you any good.
So how would you find that? Because most people wouldn't have any idea about that and wouldn't make the connection and wouldn't know what to
do. It's amazing how many people actually do know there are certain places in their house where they like to be and where they don't like to be, or that feel good or that don't feel good.
That's really interesting. I've lived in my flat for 16 years. It's the longest I've lived anywhere in my entire life. I can't believe it's 16 years this next month. And what's kept me there is that when I was house hunting down here and the estate agent showed me around and opened the front door, I felt my flat, my apartment, hug me.
Yes.
And it does yes. exactly the same every time I walk through my front door.
Is it wonderful?
Yes. And I thought, oh.
I've come home.
And it's every single time I walk through my front door, I have this feeling of being enveloped.
Embraced.
In good energy.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I do get what you mean,
absolutely.
Actually.
And, of course, also in this area, we've been invaded by...
Been invaded by
all sorts of invaders. So there's been a lot of negative energy coming in, and that also has a memory in the land.
It does.
So it's a question of just finding out where those places are, which you have to learn how to do it. Then
Fantastic.
There are various ways that you can help.
So I can't believe that we've gone on to just over 50 minutes. Oh dear. Stop speaking now. When is this book, Sacred Earth, going to be available?
Oh, it's going to be a while, yes.
Is it?
I've only started it, and it usually takes me about 6 months to a year to finalise a book, because it takes a few months to write, and then I need to edit it and so on. I don't like it to go out unless it's perfect.
Keep updated with it. It would be fantastic.
But When the Earth Cracked is just coming out, which is the third one in the Mysterious Marsh series.
Fantastic.
On Friday.
Brilliant. Brilliant. Marion, thank you. It's been an absolute joy. I can't believe that feels like 5 minutes, not 50. It's been wonderful.
Thank you very much. I've really enjoyed talking to you.
This has been Katie Day with Creating Ripples. Listen in and be part of the revolution that is rocking the world. Women over 50 are the new future. We are awesome, fearless, fabulous, inspiring, passionate, courageous. In fact, we just rock.
Yes.